So good afternoon. We have first ICT forum of this semester, and we have the speaker here about data driven business in Stockholm. The topic is artificial intelligence, digital disruption. Welcome.
Thank
you. You are second time visiting us.
Yes.
So the format is following that you have 30 minutes time, and then we have 15 minutes discussion, and after that we have coffee.
My name is Fredrik Ring. I work with Tieto. Might have one of the most interesting jobs in the world right now. I'm coaching and managing a portfolio of startups that are developing artificial intelligence-based business, basically. So I will tell you a bit about what's happening in AI, give some example. I will tell you a bit about how we in Tieto operate. How do we do this kind of thing in Tieto? Because it's a bit different from what we usually do. Then we will spend a bit time on dangers, aspects of AI that we need to think more about. So first, just to give a short, I know that many of you knows this, but maybe not all of you. We speak a lot about machine learning, and the traditional way. I met a woman from the Swedish Research Institute. She spent 30 years on trying to make a robot pick different things up, random things. And this is a bit tricky because with the technologies at hand, you need to instruct the robot exactly what to do. You know, how hard to crash, to learn what type of material is it, and so on. This is Baxter. Baxter cost $20,000. Anybody can buy Baxter, put Baxter in a garage, and start a new manufacturing business. Super easy to program. So what they did here was that they put Baxter in front of a lot of things, and then trained Baxter with a machine learning algorithm. Basically, to spend 2 weeks trying to pick things up. And at the beginning, of course, Baxter dropped everything after 20 seconds. But when Baxter was succeeded a bit more, then Baxter got rewarded. And at the end of the day, Baxter learned how to pick many things up. It actually did 10,000 tries to teach Baxter to learn to pick some things up. And this is very different. We're no longer programming the computer in the normal sense. Now we are training the computer in order to learn things. And in that way, the computer can be much more flexible. This is ongoing now. This is in London. It's a pilot with 1.2 million people. It's a nurse online. So you have this service probably in Finland that you can call a nurse and then you can get some advice and maybe, the time slot in the hospital. But this nurse is a set of algorithms that basically analyzes your symptoms and gives you an advice. And in certain conditions that are a bit complicated, it has a number of video feeds. So then it shows a video of an MD explaining what to do. And if it's too complex that they can't handle the situation, you get connected to a physical nurse that, you know, have wider knowledge. So this is an example of how the AI and people kind of work together in order to put for the greater best. I met a startup recently that they are doing this for Kenya. So the problem is Kenya is that people live very, very far from the closest doctor, and they can't afford to get there, or they might not have time to get there. So they're developing this, but everybody has a mobile phone. So they're developing this kind of solution in order for more people in Kenya to get access to healthcare, basically, which is a good thing. This is another example. There are many like this. There are now the traditional way is that you're a senior lawyer, and then you have this junior lawyers working for you, digging for information and find relevant cases and so on. There are now commercial software, so we see a new business model happening now, that some of these senior lawyers, they go away from the big law firms to start their own business, and they work with an AI lawyer as a junior lawyer. And of course, this AI lawyer can scan for complex information and much, much more information than the traditional junior lawyers. So this has created a completely new way of driving a law firm, which is now the big law firms is also trying to use these AI algorithms to replace junior lawyers. But the problem is, of course, that the normal way of becoming a senior lawyer is that you spend some time as a junior lawyer. So it kind of disrupts the value chain in the law firms. I think this is interesting. There's been now an explosion of chatbots. So most of the banks are now implementing chatbots. And some of the chatbots are just taking care of very, very simple things, like connecting you to a person and ask some very simple questions. Then we also see, I saw in one of my banks, they have this complete advisor service. So I actually answer a couple of questions, or quite a lot of questions, and then it puts together a portfolio. But it's not only that they put together a portfolio, they actually manage that portfolio over time, selling and buying financial products for me. And everything is done by an AI, completely automated. But what this one is doing is that it's not only, a bot giving you advice. It's actually analyzing your feelings. So we now have AI that when you do chat, it analyzes and tells the people you chat with or the AI that this is an angry, not too happy customer. This is a customer who is really happy, probably want to buy something. And now there are some algorithms that one, it analyzes your voice, and depending on your voice, it can tell the person on the other side if you're angry or happy or what type of personality you have. And also, if you're getting into an office, it can analyze your face expression and give data about in what emotional state you are. So these AIs are getting much, much more emotional over time. And then this is another example. I think this is happening a lot right now. The first kind of story that happened was that, you know what this is? Some of you must have seen this. It's an antenna from a satellite. So since the 60s, one of the most crucial part of any satellite is the antenna, because that is, how can you steer the satellite. And designing the antenna is a really tricky thing. So a lot of scientists have been working on antenna design at NASA. And then there was this student who said that, why not let an AI design the antenna? So he tried to apply something called evolutionary algorithms on the antenna, which means that you put a lot of factors in that this is the kind of space you're active in, this is the limitations, and this is your focus. And then this algorithm tried out a huge amount of different design. And he went to get this outcome. He went to NASA and said, "You're crazy, we won't listen to you." And then he was walking around and trying to convince people that this was smart. And after a while, NASA agreed to look at it. And he outperformed everything, every antenna design that any person has done. And now we see that architects are starting to use these evolutionary algorithms, or genetic algorithms. This is an example of furniture design partly done by these algorithms. Game developers are starting to use the algorithms. So this is actually examples where the algorithms are becoming creative and solving solutions in new ways. And when we look at this from a business point of view, we see some trends. One is that a lot of business processes are being digitalized. And these are traditionally simple things, like if you're an insurance company and you say that if you have a certain income, you're allowed to have a certain insurance and so on. Those are easy decisions. But now more and more complex decisions are being made by AIs. We see that customer experience are being digitalized. We see that bots is coming in everywhere, and we are much more governing the customer experience based on each individual's customer needs. So the first thing you do is that you look at the history of the customer, and maybe even have data from what kind of website the customer has been visiting recently, and then you tailor your experience for the customer based on different algorithms. Pretty advanced now. And then we see that products and services are being digitalized. So we work a lot in manufacturing, everything from elevators to coffee machines and stuff like that. And what we see our customer wants to do, they want to make all of these products intelligent. They want to make the coffee machine know what kind of coffee that the customer will have and when it needs service and so on. So we see, and these that companies that are producing things, they want to go from selling things to selling services, making these machines more intelligent. I think there are two trends. One is that the machines need to get more intelligent, and the second one is that it needs to be connected with other machines, so that the coffee machine knows or is connected with the elevator, and when the elevator gets to the right floor, it starts making coffee. You know, everything is connected. And then we see also that a lot of new types of business model is coming into the mix. And I think that the one thing we speak a lot about is network-based business models, or platform-based business models, or ecosystem-based business models. So traditionally, if you are in hotels, of course, the best and, you know, most valuable and profitable hotel chain in the world, like Hilton, is owning plenty of hotels. They have the biggest and best hotels at the best sites in the world. And when they get old, they need to, you know, renew them, and they need to buy new locations all the time, and they build their brand. This is the traditional logic. So it's very much based on assets. What we see now in this network orchestrated business model is that actually they make a value out of not having a lot of assets. It's not about having assets. It's about orchestrating an ecosystem where somebody else has all of the assets, and you're just in the middle of orchestrating the whole thing, earning money on the transactions. So like Uber or Airbnb, or I don't know if you have this in Finland, but if you have stuff at home, you can get out on this site, and then you can borrow it from your neighbors, or let your neighbors borrow your stuff, and somebody is a platform in the middle taking a small amount of money for doing that. So it's happened everywhere. Or like Facebook or this guy, what they do is that they mediate people that create content of different types. So all of a sudden, it's not important. It's even, it makes you really slow if you own too much assets. Now it's about being the one who orchestrates. The latest research, quite comprehensive, shows that these orchestrator business models, those companies, they are growing faster than any other types of companies. They are more profitable than any other types of companies, and they are more valuable than any other types of companies. So I think the big question now for companies like Tieto and other companies is, can we turn some part of our business into this kind of orchestrator, you know? Could we be the orchestrator of APIs or something like that? To try to get in away from this paradigm that you need to own everything. What we do then, in data-driven business, is that we run this in a bit of a different way than the rest of Tieto. The thing is that we work with AI. Most of the concept or ideas that we try to realize, we actually don't know if any customer want to buy it. We don't know if the technology will work. It's not like with our financial services product where we add a feature or something. Everything is completely unknown for us. So what we need to do is that we need to try many, many things and not spend too much money on those things, and then accept that almost everything we try will fail. So we have this process where we work first with collecting and refining ideas. And we do this in different ways. Often we do it with we put a bunch of experts and customers in the room, and then we do some brainstorming, and then we do some research and some validation, and then we got an idea after this. So that is the first thing we do. After this phase, 90% of the stuff that we have here, we just skip, because it doesn't make sense. But 10% we get into the next phase, which we call incubation. And we right now we're trying to have about 20 different incubation startups going on in parallel. And in the beginning, this is we don't put a lot of resources in this. So typically, the first thing we do is that we create what we call a value hypothesis, an idea about we can create value for somebody. And then we go down and we speak with users and customers and so on. Yeah. So I can tell you one example. We had an idea that people that live in the city, some people that live in the city have own forest that is very far from where they live. And they don't really know what kind of forest they have. And they don't know what to do with it. They don't know what to sell them, what they have to do to take care of their forest. So we have this idea, why don't we do a virtual forester, an AI that can actually analyze their forest and come up with a proposal how they should manage their forest. Simple idea. That was our value assumption. And we took that into incubation. Then we went out to speak to a lot of people living in the cities, that old forest. And they said, great idea, I really want this, but I don't want to pay for it. So this is typical. That was the wrong idea, because even if they thought that it was good, it was not good enough to pay for. And this is exactly the type of things we do in this phase. When we have done that, and if we succeed, then we do a prototype or a mock-up, you know, to display the product that we aim to develop, but also to test this in the real situation with the customer. And then we go to users and customers, and we test it, and we remodel, and we change. And very often we try to do daily iterations. So every day we should change something in our product, very, very fast, in order to make it work. And at the end of the day, we do what we call an MVP, a minimal viable product. And this is a product that somebody buys, and where we have a proof point that this product has a market. And if we get 20 incubations in here, less than 5 will go to this MVP stage. The rest we will find, you know, somewhere at the, it will be disqualified, because it's impossible to do, the technology doesn't work, we don't get enough data, or whatever it is. But this is the kind of typical way where it goes. And to work like this is a bit different. You know that we are like 13,000 employees in Tieto, so it's a fairly huge company. But we don't have a lot of like innovators, data scientists, hack teams and stuff like that. So when we have built this organization, we have been recruiting most of the people from startups, some people from universities, to build a very different culture and different types of people that needs to be able to be really fast and work with another mental state that large companies have. And we have a few things. One thing, of course, is that we have a business platform. And this is nothing strange. It's that Tieto has many, many customers. We have many, many salespeople. We have consultants that are experts in different industries. Of course, when we build startup and AI business, we utilize this business platform. So it's comparatively easy for us to find customers compared to other startups. Then we have a technical platform. So we have built an AI platform and a data platform, something called a data lake. And then we use different types of AI frameworks on top of that data lake. So this is a platform, because we think that in each startup we are developing, we cannot reinvent the wheel and create a new technology. So we create a shared technology platform for all of the startups. And then we have an innovation platform. So we have these processes. We work with something called design thinking and lean startup processes. And we have then coaches that are working together with our startups and helping them to develop their business. So these are fundamental things that we have. And a few lessons learned. around the startups that we have now, because we started quite late. We started in November last year, but we already have a quite significant portfolio of startups in different phases. Some of these startups we are already selling on the market, so they are products that exist. Some of them are still in experimentation mode, research mode, like in ideation or incubation. So in very, very different modes. But I can also say I've been in many startups, and I've been a CEO of a couple of startups and so on. But AI startups are different than other startups. That is one of the conclusions that we have. Here's an example. We're working in the healthcare welfare. Basically, we're working with predictive healthcare and healthcare quality analytics. And what we are able to do, we're using like school data, data from municipalities, data from hospitals, and combine this in order to try to find different types of patterns. We're also mining journal data. So for example, if you have a journal that says that I stopped smoking 5 years ago, or I just went from 10 cigarettes to 5 cigarettes, we are able to read that kind of data from a journal and make it a structured data. We can use it in our health quality care analytics. So this is stuff that we're doing right now using different types of algorithms. And when we do this, we have been able to create a team. We were able to get a really one of the best data scientists to move from San Francisco and Amazon to Finland to work with us. So we have been able to create a small team with skill sets that are partly overlapping and partly complementary. And the kind of working environment is that we try to do one pilot or one design experiment every day. So every day we should do something new that should add value in the experimentation that we do. So extremely high speed in these teams. And we try to keep the teams really, really small when we do it. But there are, I spoke about that there are some challenges. Our biggest challenge, and this goes for the stuff we do in forest industry, the stuff we do in manufacturing, the stuff we do in healthcare, is to get data. We had one example where we signed with a customer that we would get data, school data, and we checked it with our lawyers and their lawyers and everything. And after 3 months, they came back and said, you will not get the data. It's too controversial. Everything is completely legal and straight, but still too controversial. In another case, it took 5 months from signing the agreement to getting the data, simply because there were so slow processes and decision making at the customer side. This means that we have a team here and they need to wait 5 months in order to start experimenting, because we cannot start experimenting without data. So this is, it's the same in the forest industry now. Now we're speaking with the big forest companies and we're getting into this co-creation mode, but we need to speak with the C-level people, and it's really, really takes a long time before we get access to the data we need in order to act. So that is one of the most difficult things for us. So this is what I talked about, the virtual forest then. This idea now that we skipped originally, we have turned this to another type of idea now where we go work together with forest companies to help them to automate forest valuation, to get their stock levels down and to increase the productivity in the sawmills. So we were able to turn that around to another business model, basically. But it's the same here. It's slow because we work with high-level decision makers and we need a lot of data in everything we do. So, the last part of this is about a bit controversial question. I think it's good to end with this because it often raises a lot of questions. Is this all good then? Some of it is good. I think that there's a number of cases. We have one startup that is looking at or is listening, actually analyzing voice, especially if you get time series voice, so that you can record a voice every month, the same voice, and you should see how it changes. Then you can use that in order to predict certain type of diseases. There is also similar experiments done, I think an Israeli startup now doing, that they film your face And they do it every month over a 2-year period, and then they can predict Alzheimer. So we see that these are you know, a kind of data processing that no human being can do. It's impossible. It was impossible before we got this type of deep learning neural networks. So this is really something where the AI is complementing the humans and create something that is bigger and better. But then we get this. This is a researcher at Stanford University. So he's looking into, he thinks, I can see if somebody's gay or straight. I can see if somebody is left wing or right wing. I can see if somebody is smart or stupid. Research going on right now, analyzing pictures of people. You feel a bit uncomfortable. Let's put this in Russia and then in North Korea. You know what will happen? I think this is also a huge debate. You know, AI, recent research shows that 50% of all jobs in US could be replaced by AIs. Quite serious research shows that 50% of the US workforce will be replaced by AIs. This is a recent report now from Deloitte, so not that scientific, but still they mean that in UK then 800 jobs were lost, but they got 3.5 million new jobs. But I think the problem with this is that we have had this kind of industrial revolutions in history, and always mankind has picked up. But the problem is now that the speed that this is happening is governed by Moore's law. It's doubling every 18 months. And soon we will have the computers, we will have the DNA processors, and it's not doubling every 18 months then. It's, you know, 100 times faster like this immediately. So the problem is here that in the old kind of industrial revolutions, there's always been time to change the society. But this is now so fast. So the debate is it too fast for the society to adopt? Or mankind not adoptable enough to handle AI, basically? I think it's a really valid debate. Here's another thing that I told you about the automated advisor. This started already in the 80s. You know that 84%, and this is higher now, this number is a couple years old, 84% of all of the trading in US is done by hyper-fast machines. There's no people triggering anything. It's machines and algorithms that are doing the trading. And this has meant that a few people get incredibly healthy. How do you think the fairness of these computers doing in milliseconds, you know, trading based on real-time information from all kinds of sources, and you sitting at home Friday evening buying shares from a company? What is the fairness in that trade? This is already here now. It's not science fiction. There are now people who want to put in a delay of 1 second in all trade in order to create more fair situation in financial services. So really interesting. And there's also another debate that I think is interesting. What is happening now, you know that Amazon now have 50% of the US online trade, Amazon. They know more about the US people than anybody else. They actually send goods to people before they buy it, close to their homes, because their algorithm know that, you know, enough people will buy this at this place, so we should send it there. They know, if you look at the web page, that there is 13.6% chance that you will buy this product if you see that ad. They know it exactly. They have so much data, and Google has all of the data, you know, all geographies. They have data, they have all of the books scanned. So this and the strategy is really clear. Amazon is not a trading company, it's a data company. Google's, their whole strategy, sometimes they start to collect data and nobody understands why. Because they see that they can create a future business model based on data. And this is not Swedish or Finnish or European, these companies are global. So the power these companies get, and in my view, it's maybe the most difficult thing is that this leads to redistribution of wealth in the society. So a few people that owns this data will have a lot of power. You see already in the US, if you look at the universities, these super rich people, they are sponsoring the universities. They're actually deciding what programs they should focus on depending on their own personal interest. So they build the agenda in the society in a way that is very far from where we are now in the Nordics. But this is happening now in the US. And then, I think the last part here today, some interesting stuff is happening. I don't know if you saw it, it's happened with Facebook, it's happened with Google. They're working with these AIs that are negotiating or battling each other. And all of a sudden, they found out by accident that these AI are developing their own language. Because English is not the optimal language for two AIs to communicate. And I think that was Facebook, they put in the reward. So if they use English, you know, they get a higher score. So they started to fix this. But this is really interesting because it's a symptom of something else. It's a symptom of that we're getting into a situation where we no longer understand the AI, why they think as they do. We now have Google. They claim now that they have designed AIs that are designing algorithms. And they also claim that the algorithms these AIs are designing are equal with the algorithms that the best data scientists in the world designs. So now AIs are designing AIs. So really, really some scary things is happening in that. And we have these big GAN networks where you use one AI to train another AI. You have one AI that is trying to forge a Picasso painting, and then you have another AI that is trying to understand if it's a fake Picasso or a real Picasso. And then they battle each other until they get excellent in forging and creating Picasso paintings. This is the kind of new technology where AI are developing the models by battling each other. So a lot of things is happening where we are being less dependent on people doing it, and AI is cleaning data, AI is creating algorithms, AI is developing new languages. And the big debate is, you know, will this happen? Will we get into a situation where the AI will become, you speak about artificial general intelligence or super intelligence. Will this happen? And when will it happen in that case? And what happens then? Because then you get into a situation where there are no longer AIs that are creating more intelligent, people that are creating more intelligent AIs. There are actually AIs that are creating more intelligent AIs. And then this intelligence gets out of control. I don't know if I believe in this, but people like Hawkins and Elon Musk, they believe in this. So pick the smart people. So, question, thoughts?
Thank you very much.
No niin, olkaa hyvä kysymyksiä.
Joo.
Eikä on kysymys.
Yeah. I have a very, very simple question.
So, come here, that we can hear.
Yeah. It was very interesting presentation. Concerning, we are now going to the digital economy and there is nearly 10 zettabytes per year creating 10,000 or 21. How do you see the biggest challenge at the end? Because you are a digital company, SaaS. For instance, there is a lack of Google coders in the insurance company, and there is a lot of software, they can change it. But how do you see these security issues and the biggest challenge in your company?
The biggest challenge in our company, I think, is
Please repeat the question.
Yeah. So we have a lot of legacy software in Tieto. There is a lack of people that can manage that, and there is a lot of information to be managed. How does Tieto intend to manage the situation? Is that?
Yeah.
So I think in our company, of course, we spend a lot of time and money in understand these kind of processes that we speak about, managing data operation, managing applications. We are also looking into heavily how can we robotize those processes, put machines to run part of them at least, in order to make them as efficient and secure as possible. It's one thing we're doing. I think that when it comes to Tieto, what we need to do is that we need to have one part of our company that is relatively stable, where we can't touch too much. We need to streamline the way we operate and digitalize as much as possible, but we need to keep it very safe, very robust, and working. And then we need to take another part of our company and say that, hey, the world is totally changing. We need to do this in a completely different way, and we need to experiment. So we need to get into what we call multimodal ways of operating in a company like Tieto. Part of it, extremely robust, secure, but still we're working on robotizing and improving every day. And part of it, running a completely different way. And then when we speak about our platform, and this is something we spend a lot of time on, because there is a contradiction between hyper-fast experimentation on one side and high security at another side, which is problematic. So we're looking at this kind of layered architecture where we have a platform in the bottom that we don't change that often. And it's really tested and secured in every way. So then the higher we get in the layers, the more agile we can be. So on the top, we're working with like use cases, and we can change things every day and create new products. But the base, the platform in the bottom, is not that agile. It's really, really robust and secure. And this, yeah?
It's you have the same message that your big data, head of big data.
Okay. Thanks.
And before you, Camille, keep answering, I have a question to you. I speak close to
yeah.
you. It was very nice, this innovation process. Could you bring that process to this place?
Yeah, more than happy to.
Then it would be interesting what startups and so on. It would be very welcome. How long time it takes the process? First step, second step, several days or
the whole incubation. Yeah. The first process, the ideation process, yeah. takes 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Yeah. Then the incubation process, where you go from an idea to a minimum viable product. So at the end, you have a product. In normal case, that takes 4 months. But then you run into the situation that, oops, I will not get the data until 5 months later. So what I would say that our experience now from managing AI startups is that it depends on data availability.
Yes.
But 4 months is ideal.
Yes, we had 100 schools developing their own idea in the summer time, students. And
yeah.
It would be nice to continue. They have done already first. Jukka, you have some questions.
Okay, thanks for a nice point of view. In the old world, it was clear that the value creation was based on putting together labor, capital, energy, raw materials, and machinery. Now, most successful rising industries, in their case, value creation is mostly based on data. So we have agile new industries, and then we have like traditional industries stuck to the physical world.
Yeah.
Which kind of industries do you think that will next wake up or should wake up? I mean industries like construction business. Mm-hmm. Where do you see that the revolution will next take place?
maybe you repeat the question.
Yeah, so we see now that the traditional kind of value creation based on different resources, materials, people, I don't know, ability to grow value with the traditional assets. And now we see completely new types of new ways of creating these assets. So we have seen now the hotel industry has changed, for example. What will be the next industry? I think that there are two things that is happening now. One thing is that many I met with ABB. They have their incubator. Telia have Division X, which is a digital business division of Telia. Ericsson has also their innovation lab and incubator. So what happens is that most big companies that are a bit into technology are developing new business areas to find their this platform-based or network operator business model. So that is one part that the big companies are trying to fight back to find it. And then I meet with hundreds of startups that find every asset you can ever imagine and try to make an orchestrated model of it. There are so many. So everybody is, I don't know which is the one that will definitely happen now. I think that, you know, I've been working with forest industry lately, and I don't think it will happen in forest industry anytime soon, because the whole process and industry and culture is too slow. So I don't think that will happen. Construction, I don't know, you know, it's about culture and the people and how decision making is working. And is it possible for a startup to come in and disrupt construction the way that Uber and Airbnb did? I'm not so sure. But I you know, every day you see new startups popping up with the same kind of business model in different new areas where they try to utilize unutilized assets basically in a new way. But I don't have a good view actually on exactly which industry will be the next to be kind of hit by this.
Thank you very much. I ask now Ari to give some words as well. So thank you very much for your encouraging lecture. And Ari is new leader of digital, how is digital leader of the university.
CDO would be one.
And he will give in some words. Thank you.
Yes, so thank you, Fredrik. Fredrik is actually my ex-boss and also friend, so he was a really good boss, so being friends still. Yeah, so I started here in mid-May, so a few months behind, and a lot of great ideas we have already. Pekka has brought up this kind of smart campus thinking, which is actually something which we aim to start. We aim to do something around this kind of innovation process. We have been evaluating some tools like Spigits, but of course it's a lot of process thing and management thing. By the way, are you using any kind of tools in this first phase?
Trello. Simple.
Yes.
But we're looking into Spigits also, so maybe we already have it in here.
Yeah, so intention is to get more of this potential which we have in this university, students, in employees, and in our partners as well, to develop those things. But still in planning phase, I would say. Okay, or input this well.
So thank you very much. Who wants to continue discussion is welcome to Pieta. We have their coffee. I know that there's not so many place at the moment, but anyhow, welcome to that place. The faculty will pay the coffee.